From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is praising protests in several states aimed at urging governors to reopen the economy despite serious concerns about the coronavirus.
Look, they want to get, they call cabin fever. You've heard the term. They've got cabin fever. They want to get back. They want their life back. Their life was taken away from them.
Well, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf is one of the governors weighing whether to extend statewide stay-at-home orders beyond April 30th. And the governor says he will veto a bill lawmakers sent him last week to reopen some businesses classified as non-essential. Joining us now is Pennsylvania State Senator Scott Martin, who is a supporter of the bill. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
So, Senator Martin, your governor says this legislation is irresponsible. Health officials are concerned. Opening up the country in this way could set back any progress to containing the coronavirus. Why are you advocating for this legislation now?
Well, I greatly disagree, though I admire his intentions. Pennsylvania has taken some of the most draconian measures in terms of the shutdown. Some people say it's a reopening of the economy bill. It's not. It's to create a level playing field for a lot of our industries who really were shut down that haven't even been shut down in other states.
So what you're asking for is clarity. So there's some uniformity between what businesses are open and what businesses are non-essential.
Absolutely. I still believe there are things that should be shut down that don't serve an essential purpose whatsoever. It's just the clarity aspect has really led to chaos here. And one of the reasons why we're having another, a protest outside as we speak.
Can you tell me what non-essential businesses are we talking about here?
Well, first and foremost, one of the big ones is construction. Online auto sales is another, or even real estate agencies being able to operate virtually. These are the kind of things that we saw what has occurred here that we haven't seen in a lot of other states, including some of the states who have been hit even harder by the coronavirus. Even in my own district, I have one school district that was allowed to continue their high school construction project because they have to be in school by August. And literally within 3 miles away, another school was denied the opportunity to do the same with the same guidelines. What really adds to it even more, we have over 1.3 million people that have filed for unemployment, and our system has been overwhelmed. People still haven't seen checks, and that's kind of added to has really stoked the fires of a lot of our constituents here in PA.
I'd like for you to weigh in on these protests. Some people are not social distancing during these protests. And in another state, someone was seen carrying a swastika. Your response to this outcry from people in this way?
Well, if I see anyone carrying a swastika, that's idiocy, and there's no room for that in our country. I will say with any of the protesters going on, obviously it's the right to protest. I hope that they practice social distancing measures that they put in place that are recommended to them. But it's really, I think, starting to show the real angst of a lot of our folks here.
I want to ask you about something else. So Pennsylvania is the only Northeast state that hasn't extended its time for social distancing past April 30th. Your governor, Wolf, is trying to coordinate reopening efforts with six other Northeast states. Wouldn't it make sense to work together on this?
It would absolutely do it. But what he has yet to do is actually work with anyone in Pennsylvania in terms of the legislature who are representing his constituents in terms of trying to find their way through an unemployment system that seems to not be able to handle this. We're trying to create a task force for analyzing the impact on our healthcare systems. There's a spirit of wanting to cooperate with him, but he has not yet shown that at all with the General Assembly. And we're on the front lines dealing with our constituents from every angle, the medical angle, the financial angle, the unemployment angle. And we'd like to work with him on it.
Scott Martin is a state senator in Pennsylvania. State Senator Martin, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, let's go now to Jacksonville, Florida, where beaches reopened on Friday, despite pleas to give social distancing more of a chance to work. The beaches opened the same day the death toll in Florida peaked. Jacksonville Beach Mayor Charlie Latham defended the decision this morning on Fox News.
We thought that the public was ready to maintain the social distancing standards and to exercise good judgment And it's paid off. It's paid off really well.
For more, we're joined by Melissa Ross from member station WJCT in Jacksonville. Melissa, there are still some restrictions on the beaches. What are they, and are people following the rules?
Sure, Jeremy. Good to be with you. So, yeah, the Jacksonville beaches are now open from 6 a.m. to 11 a.m. each morning and from 5 o'clock to 8 o'clock each evening. You are expected to maintain 6 feet of social distance, although you're not required to wear a mask. Beachgoers are allowed to walk, run, bike, swim, or surf, but no beach chairs or towels allowed, no groups of larger than 10. We've seen police, lifeguards, Jacksonville Fire and Rescue out there patrolling the beachfront to try to enforce those rules. Now, for the most part, people are following the rules, but not completely. And of course, that's led to criticism of this decision by people here in the state, including some public officials from other Florida cities. They've called the decision irresponsible.
Well, and I know that you were tweeting out over the weekend asking listeners to tell you what they thought of it. We're seeing the hashtag Florida Morons trend on Twitter right. In response to the opening of the beaches. How are people in Jacksonville feeling about the decision?
It's been an incredibly mixed reaction, Jeremy. On the one hand, there has been horror over the decision. Some Jacksonville residents are really concerned about this. They think that the reopening of the beaches will lead to a new spike in COVID cases. They also fear that opening the beaches up right now will just lull everyone into becoming more complacent overall about the pandemic. But there's an equally vocal group of residents who love this idea. They're ready to go to the beach, and they're angry about the national media coverage. They think it's unfair. They resent it, and they've been vocal about that as well.
What about the overall picture when it comes to COVID-19 in Florida at this point, in terms of both cases and deaths? Where are we?
Sure. Statewide, the Florida Department of Health today reports nearly 27,000 coronavirus cases, 789 deaths. In Northeast Florida, we have 1,408 cases, 34 deaths. So Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry is saying since our local hospitals are not at capacity and that cases appear to be leveling off, he's comfortable with this partial reopening of the beaches. That said, epidemiologists are quick to point out that relaxing restrictions too quickly can easily lead to a new spike in cases. And so it's a story we'll continue to be following here at WJCT in Jacksonville.
That is Melissa Ross at WJCT in Jacksonville. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the negotiations continue between Republicans and Democrats in Washington today on what could be the next package of aid to small businesses hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic. The last batch of money, which was included in the $2 trillion relief package, quickly ran out. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Jill, if, as expected, Congress injects hundreds of billions more for small businesses, is it going to be enough?
I doubt it. I'm hearing from business owners and from bankers alike that the systems were just overrun. Remember that this fund, this payroll protection plan, was basically exhausted within 12 days of starting. And so it's unclear whether there will be yet another round. But if we were to add another, say, $300 billion worth, most officials, both in D.C., most business owners believe that this will actually run dry at least within a couple to 3 weeks.
Is the government likely to change anything about the way these loans and grants are being distributed? We do see the news that Shake Shack, which originally qualified for one of the small business loans, has decided to return its $10 million after outrage.
Yes. And just remember, as you said, that this was perfectly legitimate because under the original rules, there was a provision that said, even if you're a big, huge company, if you have fewer than 500 employees in any one location, you could apply for the payroll protection, which is what Shake Shack did. Now, Shake Shack also is a publicly traded company that can go out to the public markets and raise money. And clearly, after the huge blowback, returning the money, but there's lots of other companies that are not going to return the money. I think the problem is that when you're trying to do a widespread disaster relief, it's hard to pick and choose who's the most needy in that moment. So, In fact, if you're a small business, you wouldn't care if a big company got it because as long as you got it. If we could get more small businesses money, I think that the complaints would be diminished.
One more thing I want to ask you about. A big story in the markets today is oil. Prices of oil down to under $11 a barrel in some places. What is going on? Didn't Saudi Arabia and Russia agree to cut production?
Yes, they did. But you know what? The world remains awash in oil. And of course, that's due to the pandemic-induced deep recession. You know, with the drop-off in economic activity, there's no demand for energy products. No gas or jet fuel is necessary. Price of oil is down about 85% this year. It's unbelievable.
But if you look to the oil futures in the fall, they're actually higher. What explains that?
Oh, I'm glad you're asking me a wonky question for an old commodities trader. This is called contango, and it's not a dance. And it means that when prices are higher in the future than they are in the present. So if you're an oil trader, what you're betting is that once C-19 runs its course later this year, economic activity will pick up, and that will push up the price of oil. So now say contango with me, ladies and gentlemen. It feels good on your mouth, doesn't it?
And C-19, that's the first time I've heard that. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News, thank you.
Take care.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
And we're listening to some new music through this coronavirus pandemic. That's Hey Lover, featuring veteran jazz vibraphone player Roy Ayers, and it's from a recording provocatively titled Jazz is Dead 001. A pair of hip-hop collaborators dreamed up the project, and they join us now. Composer-producer Adrian Young, welcome.
Hey.
And DJ producer Ali Shaheed Muhammad, who is known for his work with the pioneering hip hop group and one of my favorites from the 1990s, A Tribe Called Quest. Welcome.
Hey. How you doing?
I am well, thank you. So, Ali and Adrian, clearly you don't believe jazz is dead. Adrian, tell us more about this title.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the greatest joys of our life right now is talking about this phrase, jazz is dead, you know, because everybody has their own definition, right?
Yeah.
And when you hear the term jazz is dead, you know, then the next thing you think of, well, who's the guard, you know? So is it the kid with the beat machine sampling jazz? Is it the offbeat record connoisseur? Is it the old jazz generation? Is it the newer up and comers? Or is it the retired couples that are on the soft jazz cruises, you know? I guess the bigger question when you hear jazz is dead is who gets to say what matters? And you know, for us, we look at it as like those people that protect the art as pioneers in this progression, and that's what we're trying to do with jazz is dead.
Well, we talked about Roy Ayers up top. What was it like working with him?
Well, for people like myself and Ali, music matters to us way more than it should to the average person. So I mean, when you're in the presence of somebody like that, you know, yeah. It's like being in the presence of a God here on earth. You know, he's done so much for music. He's meant so much to our lives with music that just being in the studio with him, not even working, just being in the studio with him was just magical.
Yeah, we kind of thought about it as him adding those key notes of cool. Let's listen. Ali, you've long been influenced by jazz back to your Tribe Called Quest days. Talk about the source of that inspiration.
My introduction to jazz was through my grandmother and she was a big Duke Ellington fan, a big Ella Fitzgerald fan, and I didn't want any parts of that. So I think because I was born in 1970, and the main source of my, I guess, my era was not Duke Ellington. However, you know, when you hear groups like Earth, Wind & Fire or even Kool & the Gang, who fused jazz into what is been coined R&B, you know, it kind of opens up the palette. And the love affair grew. And so the exploration went beyond just sampling to me picking up instruments to really just get my own idea of what these greats were doing. It's just been a nonstop journey. So here we land with Jazz is Dead. Yeah. And this compilation, yeah, just based off of that continued being inquisitive about the process, being inquisitive, yep, about, you know, the communication of music and what it means to make freedom music.
To make freedom music.
Yes.
To piggyback on what Ali was saying, I mean, let's just back up. What's the first real recognized musical art form of America? It's jazz. Okay, yeah. So what is the etiology of that? Well, it's Black America's voice. You know, jazz encompassed the struggles of Black America, and we used our instruments as our voice. So when you lock into the fundamental tone, the addition of harmonics is what makes this fundamental tone different. So we're using the same instruments, but we're adding our own harmonics. We're adding our struggles, we're adding our perspectives that were blacklisted in the world, and this was our way, yeah, to finally speak out. You see what I'm saying? So that's,
yeah, I see,
that is the foundation of jazz, and it's just really a human thing. You know, you don't got to be Black, you know it's a human thing, but that's, it came from that Black struggle.
Let's listen to a very different sound than Hey Lover. Connect Zao features bossa nova luminary Joao Donato. How did that come together?
Well, Jazz is Dead is not just a label. It's a concert programming series that we've had. So we host these concerts with jazz legends and up-and-coming jazz artists. And we bring them to Los Angeles, do these crazy concerts. And at the same time, unbeknownst to the people that are going to these concerts, we're recording albums with these people. So for with Joao, you know, we brought him out here from Brazil. And part of bringing him out here was not only to have him play his beautiful music for the people, but to say, hey, let's record a full album with you to analog tape like you used to do in the 60s and 70s. And let's use these original instruments as well. And let's continue those conversations that you were starting back then, but make it more modern.
You guys also brought in a Brazilian jazz funk group called Azimuth. Here's Apocalyptico. And there is an energy here that seems very fitting for these days when our attention is taken up by the crisis on our hands. What does this music mean for you, Ali?
To me, it just is the relentlessness of existing and the ability to vibrate and unite. You know, we're in a time period where obviously we're more contemplative, you know, about mm-hmm. our individual selves, but more so we are more connected, I think, now than in any period, at least in the past 100 years. And even so, with technology and the lifestyles that we all have, where we think we're connected, where we're all, you know, have these social media aspects, but it's not a connection that has always, I think, had true depth and true consideration. And so we're now really considering one another. And I think when musicians get into a room together, there's a lot of consideration. And we certainly hope that putting out the Jazz is Dead 001 album out right now will give people some comfort and have a moment to reflect, to wonder, you know, what's next, to maybe lose your mind for a moment and then to find yourself. And to me, like, one of the really good examples of that is the song Distance Mode with Gary Bartz. To me, really highlights where we are right now. And that's just my take on it. Someone else may have a completely different experience, but that song to me, and just the title, is just like, what is going on? That's how it starts. I listen to that song, it is a question. It's like, what the heck is going on, you know? And then there's an answer, and the answer may seem sweet, it may seem uncertain, and Gary's playing just is. It just takes you through all these emotions.
You guys had been planning to tour with your jazz heroes. You know, things are in such flux right now. Is that still in the works?
I mean, the next time Ollie and I will even hit the stage, who knows? You know? But what we do know is that this stage will never be replaced with a computer. You know, the stage will never be replaced with television. It's that human connection. So we're looking forward to just have the human connection, you know, like we're looking forward to just going on Instagram and having a picture with you hugging your homies and hugging your friends. Right now, if you put that picture up, people are like, ooh, not practicing that safe distancing, you know? So, you know, in due time, hopefully the summertime we can start back, but you know, we'll see what happens.
Composer-producer Adrian Young and DJ-producer Ali Shaheed Mohammed. Together, they formed the group The Midnight Hour, and they spoke with us about their new album, Jazz is Dead 001. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Tanya.
You're listening to Here and Now. And let's head to Africa now, where 1 million coronavirus test kits are expected to be distributed starting this week. There's also some good news about several countries flattening the curve there. Joining us now from Nairobi is NPR's Ader Peralta. And Ader, how quickly are the number of cases rising across the continent?
So far, the continent has diagnosed more than 21,000 cases and more than 1,000 people have died. The WHO says that in the past week, those cases have increased by 51% and deaths by 60%. So it appears that this pandemic is accelerating here on the continent.
Yeah, I mean, the continent is huge. Which countries have managed to flatten the curve?
Ghana is actually relaxing its lockdown today, because the president says that the lockdown bought them enough time to locally produce PPE and to be able to test and trace cases aggressively enough that they think they can get a handle on this pandemic. And South Africa last week announced that the lockdown and its super aggressive testing have actually flattened the curve and helped to keep their hospitals from being overwhelmed. But one of the most famous South African epidemiologists told them that this wasn't a victory, instead that this only buys them time.
You know, here in the United States, we've been talking so much about testing. 1 million test kits, as I mentioned earlier, for the continent. That sounds like a lot, but for a continent with more than 1 billion people, that really doesn't sound like a lot.
It's not. And just like the U.S., testing is a huge issue here. South Africa, which has tested more than any other country on the continent, they have conducted more than 100,000 tests. But that's very few, less than 2 tests per 1,000 people. The U.S. is conducting about 11 tests per 1,000 people. But unlike the U.S., they already have an infrastructure because they've had to face, you know, the largest HIV/AIDS epidemic in the world. Mm-hmm. And they have contact tracers. They were able to hire 28,000 people to go into the communities. They didn't even have to train these people. So that has sort of put them at a really interesting advantage.
Yeah. You mentioned ventilators. The lack mm-hmm. of ventilators is also a problem for the continent as it is here in the United States. According to the World Health Organization, there are fewer than 2,000 working ventilators across 41 countries. 10 other countries don't have any ventilators. Are there any efforts made to address this?
Some. You know, ventilators are being donated, and the World Health Organization has been trying to source them on the open market. But right now, that's challenging because the whole world is trying to buy them. But there's also a huge lack of health workers who are trained to operate these ventilators. So many hospitals here are trying to get up to speed with last-minute trainings.
How do residents where you are feel about the way their leaders are handling this pandemic?
I mean, people here take it serious. I mean, they know the damage that a disease can cause because they've lived through many epidemics. But there's also a really huge economic dimension to this. A lot of people would like to listen to their leaders and socially distance, but the reality is, if they stay mm-hmm. home, they won't eat. And in a lot of ways, you can call this a lockdown for the rich because movement has stopped in the rich areas, but poor people have continued mm-hmm. to work because they have no other choice.
Hmm. That's NPR East Africa correspondent Eder Peralta. Eder, thank you so much for joining us, and stay safe.
Thank you, Tanya.
The coronavirus pandemic has had people cooped up at home for weeks now, which isn't easy. But imagine if you're a child who isn't safe at home. Child welfare agencies intervene in cases of abuse and neglect, and courts can remove children from parents if necessary, placing them in foster care. Most kids leave foster care. They go back home if parents address problems like getting treatment for substance abuse or mental illness or finding stable housing. Other kids are adopted or find a family through guardianship. Some age out of the system each year. All this requires monitoring and intervention by social workers and courts, and the coronavirus pandemic is making that more difficult. Joining us now is Ju-Yun Chang, who is Senior Deputy Director of the Children's Services Agency of the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. Ju-Yun, what are some of the challenges that you're dealing with because of coronavirus?
I think when I think about the challenges that the coronavirus has brought to our agency, I think about kind of the first point of contact that our families have with our system, and that's when that call comes to our hotline to report an incident of abuse or neglect. Each year, we get approximately 190,000 calls to our hotline. That translates roughly to about 500 or so calls a day. We have seen mm-hmm. a dramatic decrease in the number of calls to our hotline since our stay-at-home order went into place. And particularly, we saw that drop the day that schools actually closed in mid-March. So we've seen over a 50% decline in the number of calls to our hotline. The drop by educators is similar to those that we see in the summer months. But I think with the stay-at-home order here in Michigan, we are not only having fewer eyes on kids at the school, but also we have fewer service providers, fewer community members who might be able to see our children and to report incidents of abuse and neglect.
Because it's not as if abuse and neglect have totally stopped in the last couple of weeks. It's simply that the kids are there home with their foster parents or whomever and aren't able to make that call in private.
I think that's right, especially when you think about most of the calls that come into our system and certainly most of the cases that lead to an actual intervention by our agency have to do with issues around neglect, right? So often those are connected to poverty. You can imagine domestic violence, substance use disorder, and other poverty-related issues that impact our families pre-COVID. And so we know that those issues have not diminished during this time, and if anything, might be exacerbated, right? So we know that our families are at risk and they need services and supports, but they're not coming to our attention.
And even if you were to hear from somebody, can you make a visit to a home the way that you could before?
So we are continuing to do the child safety related work of investigating allegations of abuse and neglect. We have significantly changed the way we conduct those investigations in a couple of ways. One, we have reduced the number of staff who are actually going out into the public space to conduct those investigations down from about 1,500 staff members down to a little over 350 staff. But that also means that we're able to provide them intensive support and training about how to prepare for these types of in-person investigations. Also, we're able to give them the limited number of personal protective equipment to the staff who do have to go out in the public space.
And I imagine just a lot of virtual visits.
We do. So most of our staff are continuing to work, but they are doing their work virtually. So we visit with the children who are in foster care, those who may be at lower risk and are still in homes. We are doing lots of virtual visits with children and families.
The courts play a big role, too, in removing kids from parents or returning them to parents. What's happening with the courts right now?
So the courts have stayed open to do some emergency type of work, including emergency removal orders. So if a child has to come into foster care because staying at home is a safety risk for them, we can still process those orders in the court. But what we want to work with our courts to do is to also practice virtual court hearings so that other types of proceedings can continue, including helping children go back home. You know, nearly half of the kids who are in foster care, and there are about 12,000 kids in foster care in Michigan today, will go home. And a number of those children were, you know, days away from returning to their families before we had our stay-at-home order. And so we're hoping that those children will be able to get back home through virtual court orders. Also, a lot of children are waiting to be adopted and waiting just for that finalization order from the courts. And we hope that we can also work with courts to use technology to complete those adoptions.
What kind of a toll do you think this disruption is taking on both birth parents and on foster parents?
We actually have scheduled virtual town halls with both birth parents and foster parents. And in preparation for that, we've been collecting questions and emails from them for the last week. I read over 100 emails from birth parents, and you know, they're heartbreaking. They are really struggling with the separation from their children, not being able to see them in person. And that's particularly hard for parents with very young children, where a virtual visit just doesn't quite work. We also have resource parents or foster parents who are struggling with additional responsibilities, whether that is having to provide educational supports at home, maybe having to do so in greater financial burdens. You know, this is a balancing act for any family. And so our resource parents and foster parents are no different. They've been heroic. I just want to highlight that so many foster parents have stepped forward to say that they would be willing to take in a child into their home and even willing to take children who are COVID positive into their home as a foster child.
Now, you work for a state agency at the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. Are you concerned that the economic damage caused by the coronavirus will affect the budget that you have to deal with, and you're going to be dealing with funding cuts to your agency and other social welfare agencies as a result?
Yeah, I mean, Jeremy, that's just the reality of this work. We know that there are significant resource issues for the state that will impact all of us, and not just our budget immediately, but so many of the other budgets that help the families, right, who come to our attention. Cuts in cash assistance or housing assistance, mental health services, or access to affordable substance use disorder services. Those cuts are going to be what drive families in greater numbers into our system. And so, yeah, I worry that we will make budget decisions that have long-term impacts on child safety, but also on the well-being of families and communities. What we know is that if we move further upstream and help families when they're just struggling, those interventions in the long run cost so much less, not only financially, but also at a human level, than if we wait until those problems become crisis and removal is necessary. So I'm hoping that we will be able to continue making smart investments and things that will have a larger economic payoff.
I just want to finally ask you, if one of your kids is listening to this right now, one of the kids in your system is listening, what would your message be to that person?
My message would be for our young kids, I would tell them, I know that this is tough. I know that it's been hard to be away from your parents and your siblings and your larger community, but that we are working as quickly and as hard as possible to get you back with your families. For older youth who may be close to aging out of our system, I would tell them that we are still here for you, that we will do everything in our power to keep you in stable housing, to make sure that you stay insured and that you have the services and supports that you need.
That is Ju-Yun Chang, who is Senior Deputy Director of the Children's Services Agency at the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
A Japanese infectious disease expert says he's pessimistic the Olympic Games can be held next year. This comes after Japan and the International Olympic Committee announced last month that the games scheduled for this summer in Tokyo have been postponed until 2021. The postponement means the world's best athletes have to deal with a delay, including figuring out how to keep their bodies in top shape for a chance at the next Olympics. Jade Slayman of WHYY's The Pulse reports.
For a while after her run, Nia Akins could do nothing but stare at the numbers, big and bright on a digital display board, 2.00.71.
Nia Akins with the huge victory.
I think I just kind of sat there in disbelief after running for maybe a solid couple minutes, just kind of like looking at the time and not thinking that I'd run that.
This was back in February at a collegiate track meet in Boston. Akins had just run 800 meters, about half a mile, in 2 minutes, 0.71 seconds.
When I thought about the Olympics before that day, I think I thought, you know, it was more of a pipe dream.
Akins is a middle distance runner at the University of Pennsylvania. She says it's a bit mind-bending to imagine you could be better at something than anyone else in the world. But that time on the board, it was hers. And it was the second fastest in NCAA history.
After that, I kind of thought, like, why not really go for it and really train as though I believe that, you know, I could be top three at the Olympic trials and I could be a potential contender at the Olympic Games. I think then was when I started to dream a little bit crazier.
That performance made her a favorite for the U.S. team at Tokyo 2020. But not long after that race, slowly at first, then all at once, the coronavirus changed everything. Eventually, officials announced the Olympic Games would be postponed until 2021. Akins is still running, but things are different. It's all scaled back.
Right now, we're just training and training for the sake of routine. You know, we don't really know what we're training towards right now.
Normally, elite athletes like Akins would be working toward what's called peaking, reaching their absolute top shape at just the right time.
It's very hard to stay peaked.
That's Megan Cartafalsa, an athletic trainer at Penn. She says in track, most of the biggest meets are scheduled within this 2-week period.
That's like pretty much the longest you could possibly be at your highest elite level before your body needs to reset.
Olympic feats may seem superhuman because they kind of are. Keep the human body at the peak too long, and Carta Falsa says you could start getting injuries that you won't come back from. Strains, tears, and stress fractures. The right way to train is to only chase the peak when it's useful, and to know that the next one is coming.
You know, it's peak, kind of level out, maybe diminish, build again, peak again. So it's a constant, like, climbing up a mountain, and then the mountain continues to go up and up and up.
Training has slowed down across the board for Carta Falsa's athletes. She does physical rehab via FaceTime for some.
The mental aspect right now is probably the most challenging for these people, is to reset and understand that, you know, training isn't going to be a thing for, you know, maybe another month or two.
Elite athletes' whole lives can revolve around training. But with the pandemic, everything shut down, it's just not possible in the same way.
Everyone's daily routine has been disrupted right now. And this is a perfect storm for athletes to worry and have anxiety, because athletes tend to be more creatures of habit than non-athletes.
That's Joel Fish, a sports psychologist who's worked with a bunch of pro teams. Philadelphia Phillies, 76ers, Flyers, as well as a few Olympic teams.
You don't get to be an elite athlete unless you've developed a real discipline in terms of training for something today that may be an event that's going to take place 2 months from now, 3 months from now, 6 months down the road.
All that discipline and nowhere to put it. Fish says it can be really distressing. He's had to deal with it when athletes get hurt or benched. And he says in times like these, it's important for athletes to separate themselves from their sport. He tells me about a ball player he worked with who was benched with an injury.
He said to me, before this injury, if you would have asked me, who am I? I would have said, John Smith, the basketball player.
A year later, a year off the court, this John Smith took some courses, did a lot of reading, worked on the off-court John Smith.
Now, if you ask me, who am I? What's my identity? I'd say, I'm John Smith, who likes to play basketball. Do you hear the difference?
Nia Akins, the middle distance runner, already has another identity she can lean on.
As a runner, I think if you're only running, you tend to overthink running a lot more, and that it kind of like consumes your life. And I think, especially now with this huge pause, I am very fortunate that I have nursing school to kind of take away from that, if that makes sense.
That's right. If Akins wasn't already a hero for her feats on the field, you can add nurse in training during deadly pandemic. It's her senior year in the Penn Nursing Program.
You know, we really have been kind of pushed to the front line because we are really the ones that are providing that bedside care. I'm proud to be a nursing major right now, but it definitely is a scary time.
Akins says nursing is what she's always wanted to do, and the virus isn't going to change that. And it's not changing her plans about running either.
You know, when this is all over, as long as I'm keeping up with training and everything, that, you know, like, that didn't disappear. It's just delayed.
And since she ran that blowout race in Boston back in February, she knows she can do it again. For Here and Now, I'm Jad Slaman.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.